case for argument is Anderson versus Griffin. Yeah, Mr. Allen.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kenneth Allen for Jesse Anderson and Justine Turnbull. May it please the court, counsel. The trial of this case was flawed from voir dire to verdict. My clients, two African-American women, were involved in a car crash on a highway in Indiana with two white men. During voir dire, two of the veneering men had the shaved head look of skinheads.
This is really something. Look, which one did you use your peremptory challenge to strike, the tool and die maker or the veteran?
Both of them were menacing looking.
I asked you a question. Who you struck with your peremptory challenge? You said you used one peremptory challenge.
Yes. The more ominous of the two.
And who was that?
I don't remember whether he was a tool and die maker. In fact, he was a tool and die maker. It was Mr. Wilkie.
And he was ominous looking?
He was the younger one.
He was a little bit younger, yes, Your Honor. And he was more ominous looking. He had the beard with this shaved head. The other man didn't have a beard, I don't recall, but he did have a shaved head.
Skinheads have beards?
I'm sorry?
Skinheads have beards?
Oh, indeed they do, Your Honor, and tattoos, but it was wintertime, and they unfortunately were clothed.
We couldn't ask for an inspection of his body.
No, all we asked for was a question.
And how many peremptory challenges did you have?
I used all of the peremptories.
How many did you have? You had just three?
Yes.
We used all three. Who'd you use the other two against?
Well, the process that the court used was to impanel 14 jurors and strike three. And our belief was, based on the appearance of these two, that there was at least a rational possibility that they were members of this Aryan nation.
You didn't answer my question. Who did you use the other two peremptory challenges against?
Two other jurors whose names I can't tell you offhand.
I'm not interested in their names. What was the basis of your use of the peremptory challenges?
Well, Your Honor, it was candidly a feeling that they disliked me personally, and that was my thought. And, you know, sometimes I had that effect on people.
Yeah, but they were apparently more ominous than the guy you left on there, the skinhead.
Well, yeah, I should say, in retrospect, perhaps it was the wrong decision, but we didn't have adequate information to make the right decision, and that was the problem here. All we wanted was voir dire sufficient to allow us intelligently use our
peremptories. Would you ask people whether they were skinheads?
I think an appropriate question would be, are you involved with any church or movement that professes racial segregation or superiority? I think that would be an appropriate question. Certainly the cost of asking that question is very little, but the price of the harm in the event that the question were affirmative is egregious, and that should have been done in this case. The standard in...
Insulting, isn't it? Ask people whether they believe in racial superiority.
I think, Your Honor, it's not insulting if they're skinheads, and if it does...
Ask those two?
Pardon me?
You just asked those two?
I would just ask those two, and I asked the court to do it as a sidebar. Because it was their appearance that raised a rational possibility.
That bothers me a lot. The notion that you look at a person and from his tattoos, yeah, it's not swastika on his forehead, sure. But the notion that you look at a person and because his head is shaved, he's wearing a mustache or something, you ask him whether he's a racist. That doesn't sound right, does it?
Well, Your Honor, if you shave your head and wear facial hair...
Well, a lot of these, like this other fellow who had been in the Army for 4 years, and of course a lot of Army people have very, very short hair or no hair, so...
These were young men that lived in predominantly white working class neighborhoods that had shaved heads.
Well, the feeling that we had... The vast majority of people who live in that very few people who live in white neighborhoods are skinheads, surely.
Surely.
Most white people live in white neighborhoods. That's just about the United States.
But we know that all skinheads are racist, and we know that the skinhead movement...
No, actually, that's wrong. You know that?
Well,
No, you're actually wrong, because we had a case last year, or 2 years ago, involving Ku Klux Klan in Indiana, where we learned that one of the groups that likes to break up Ku Klux Klan rallies is called Skinheads Against Racism.
Well, there are Jews for Jesus, too, but I'm looking at the majority of
them. You haven't heard of them?
Well, I know that the skinheads were using the facility in Osceola, Indiana, for a gun range, too. And that was a Ku Klux Klan facility. My only point is...
But you haven't heard of Skinheads Against Racism?
No, I haven't.
It's a real group. And look them up on the web.
Well, I have heard, Your Honor...
More about skinheadism.
Of the Aryan Nation. And I can tell you that they do wear shaved heads, by and large, and that they are racist. And there's a rational possibility from that... Simply asking a question that costs nothing.
What's the general
other than
question?
Ensuring fear? Pardon me?
There was a general question about prejudice and racism and that sort of thing, wasn't there? I don't.
Well,
as far as the
there was no general question about prejudice or racism. No, Your Honor. And in fact, the voir dire that was conducted under Art Press, this court has found to be inadequate. The general question: can you be fair? You see,
it's a general question is what you want, because the notion of taking people on the basis of their physical appearance, I mean, you could have a person could have a shaved head, could have no hair, zero hair, because he was undergoing chemotherapy.
Perfectly reasonable answer. But
well,
he could also have one if he were a racist.
I don't like to talk about that. Right? You're asked, are you a racist? No, I'm dying of cancer. Where does this lead? There are all sorts of clues that a person's physical appearance gives off. I mean, it'd be extraordinary.
It leads to the court fulfilling its duty to seat impartial jury.
Why is your hair so neat? Do you spend all your money on beauty parlors or what? Where are you going to go
with
this?
Your Honor, I believe in Restaino versus Ross, the Supreme Court said the wiser course is to generally propound questions.
To identify
racial prejudice.
Most suspect,
requested.
Right?
Pardon me?
The lawyers. What about the people who have long hair? Men with long hair. Communists, right? You're going to ask them about that?
We have to operate on hunches and voir dire, Your Honor. But the question is having enough information.
The people with long hair, you ask them whether they're radicals.
Well, you have to have enough information to exercise the strikes reasonably, whether they're peremptory or for cause. You have to have the information. The cost of obtaining that information is a question, but the harm done to the process, the appearance of fairness, and these individuals could be overwhelming.
I mean, so if a person had very long hair, you'd say, look, I'd like to ask you about your political views, because you have long hair. And long hairs, in my experience, are kind of lefties and bohemians and so on. So please explain to me what your values are and why you don't cut your hair and so on.
How is that germane to the case? What was germane here is that we had white defendants, black plaintiffs, and a person who had a rational possibility of being a skinhead.
Well, it would be germane because, of course, the defendant wouldn't like to have... someone on the jury who disapproved of corporations.
But there is no requirement, as the Supreme Court imposed in Restaino, to defer generally to counsel when they ask the court to propound questions directed toward racial prejudice. That is something that the Supreme Court has indicated should be done, and ordinarily the court should defer to the request of counsel to voir dire under if there's a racial difference between the parties, unless there is no rational possibility, I submit to you.
Your argument is
this whole trial was really, it wasn't even about race at all. It was about the expert opinion on what went on under that truck when it went off the road.
Certainly, Your Honor, that's true.
Race was probably never mentioned in this 9-day trial.
Absolutely, Your Honor, that's true. But the question wasn't whether the trial was bound up inextricably in racial issues, because then that would elevate this to a constitutional issue. The question is simply whether or not there is any rational possibility that a man, young, in his 20s, living in a white working-class neighborhood with a shaved head and facial hair, is perhaps a member of the Aryan Nation or one of these groups that profess racial separatism. That's
that
the only question. If there's a rational possibility, then the question needs to be asked.
If you're that
That's
concerned
all.
About it, though, I'd take it, you know, if I was a district judge, I might have asked that question in a general sense to all the jurors. So put that aside for a minute. But you nevertheless decided to strike someone who you thought might not like you as opposed to this person you had some feeling about.
Precisely the point, Your Honor, because we didn't have the information to make an intelligent exercise of our peremptory or challenge. And that is the duty of the court. When the court exclusively undertakes voir dire, doesn't allow counsel to ask a question, I could have asked the question in a way I believe would have been appropriate. And if the person would have been angered at me for it, then so be it.
Did you throw him off because he doesn't like you?
That's possible. But you know what? At least my clients would feel that they had a fair shake. And there is a perception out there by African Americans that they don't get a fair shake. And that perception is reality in many cases, according to the studies that we've cited in our brief. All you need to do is ask the question, eliminate the issue, or prevent an egregious misjustice. It just makes the process a slight bit fairer. It's in line with Ristagno. It's in line with Rosales-Lopez and with all this court's precedent. All we wanted was a question so we could exercise our peremptories intelligently, and we couldn't get it.
Okay, thank you,
thank
Mr.
you.
Allen. Mr. Buchholz?
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Evans, you're exactly right. This case was about what caused a driveline to fail underneath a semi-truck on Interstate 65. It had nothing to do with race. And, in fact, as you've pointed out, counsel had the opportunity, if he felt that this other juror had a potential for bias based on race, he could have utilized his peremptory on that juror. He chose not to.
Did the jury know if they decided it was the fault of the repair shop or the company that owned the truck, who that would favor as far as...
No, actually, the representative for the active transportation was a black fellow. The representative from UHL was white, and Mr. Elliott is white. So there was diversity on both sides of the aisle as it relates to the plaintiffs and defendants in this case. And
when you say representative, you mean sitting at counsel's table?
Yeah, or sitting directly behind counsel for active transportation was a black representative of active transportation. And this case ultimately comes down to how did this driveline fail? There were three fashions that both experts agreed on: driver error, bad maintenance, or external forces acting upon the driveline. The evidence was that the plaintiff's expert said it was bad maintenance. He relied upon an inspection that occurred 5 years after the accident, 400,000 miles after the accident.
Is the driveline the same as a drive shaft?
The drive shaft itself is a portion of the
inside.
Driveline.
Oh.
The way this works is there's an engine, and then the driveline, which has... a drive shaft coming out with a U-joint at the first at the transmission. It runs to a carrier bearing, and then there's a connection to a slip yoke that then goes back to the back differential. And what the argument was in this case was, how did that fail? Because there's no question that on Interstate 65 that evening, this thing came apart. Plaintiff alleged that it failed at the second yoke by virtue of bad maintenance. He attributed that bad maintenance or bad work to my shop that it looked at
the
it 10 days earlier.
The yoke is at the back, and the yoke goes to the...
There are three yokes. There's a yoke at the transmission.
And that's not involved.
When our shop looked at it, it was loose, and we tightened it up.
But that isn't the one that failed.
That's not the one that failed.
The second one failed.
The second one failed. There's one
at
the carrier
the
bearing.
One?
At the carrier bearing. So you have this shaft from the engine to a bracket, which is what a carrier bearing is. There's a second yoke combination there, and it's called a slip yoke. And then that goes back to the first axle, where there's yet another yoke combination. So you have two half rounds back here at the first tandem, You've got another half round with the slip yoke at the carrier bearing, and you've got another half round, two half rounds at the transmission. And the argument the plaintiff's expert advanced was that the middle one failed.
So what is the function of the slip yoke? Why is there a yoke there?
I'm not an expert, but the way I understand it is that when you have changing of gears and ratios associated with the transmission to the rear differential, you need some slide associated with the torques that become involved. Slip yoke basically comes in and out,
right,
as it relates to the
so
carrier bearing.
It provides
bearing.
Flexibility.
Right.
And that's what broke? That's what...
There was no dispute about the area of failure being in that location.
Now, it's not... the yoke isn't open. Is it... It's got some metal cylinder around it?
What happened with the slip yoke, you're correct. There's a shaft that kind of elongates and works that fashion. What happens is you've got a half round and a half round and then a silver cross in the middle to help the spinning.
There's a housing around it?
There's a housing around some, not all.
Well, some of it is actually exposed to the ground?
Yes. In actuality, this shaft from the transmission to the first tandem is all spinning and in the open. There's nothing that covers it up and houses it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a housing around the slip yoke so it can slide in and out of this hollow tube.
Mm-hmm.
The arguments addressed by plaintiff's counsel's expert were that he had no idea what the lubrication was before this accident, he had no idea what the joint working angles were before the accident, and he had no idea what the phasing was before the accident. The testimony from the other witnesses was if you've got a misphasing or a misangulation, you have major shaking within the cab. 700 miles after it left our shop and went into another shop, and there was not one complaint of any shaking, any vibration, any problem. The vehicle then drove for another 4,000 miles. At the end of that 4,000 miles is when this incident occurred. And plaintiff's expert opined that there was a bad phasing, bad joint working angles, and lack of lubrication which caused the failure. The driver testified that he never felt one bump, one shake, anything until this incident where it failed. It exploded. In testimony from the witnesses following behind.
But what could the truck have hit that would cause such a disaster?
Well, it could have hit something in the road.
Trucks are pretty rugged.
Well, sure they are. But there are two fashions by which the driveline comes apart traumatically. Something coming down from above or something coming up from the road.
Well, it would have to be from below, wouldn't it?
Didn't have to be. It could have been a chain or something that hangs down from the deck that gets wrapped up. And there were dents within the slip yoke shaft, which suggested external contact by another by some type of object.
Well, what could be jumping up from the ground, from the road?
Well, if he ran over something, he was on 65. There's things that fall off of trucks all the time.
A piece of steel or rod or something that's laying in the road, and the tire hits it and pops it up.
Well. Tire hits it, or the vehicle itself hits it and pops it up into the drive line, which caused failure. And there was nobody testified, not even my expert testified as to the exact reason for this sudden failure. But the issue was whether plaintiff's expert's opinion about a slow wear failure and a solid state welding and failure of these parts by lack of lubrication was the reason for this incident, or whether it was a sudden failure by virtue of looking at the parts. There was no solid state welding visible on any of the parts. My expert went piece by piece and part by part through the artifacts that were remaining from this incident and testified to this jury that an external force caused a sudden failure of this driveline. And so it's on that basis that the jury, I believe, made a decision in favor of my client.
But the trucking company had settled before the trial.
They settled during the middle of the trial, yes.
The middle, so they, at least they never made any argument to the jury. They didn't care how it really was.
Well, actually, they made an argument to the jury against me because they had an agreement
well,
with plaintiff's counsel.
How the damages.
Yeah, how the damages went and what the percentages was. They'd get money back. And the same thing with counsel for Elliott. They received over $1 million. from these
well,
other
their,
two parties.
Their incentive to argue about the cause was diminished.
Sure. And in fact, because of those agreements, plaintiff's counsel put on virtually no evidence against these other two parties. And in fact, in closing argument, said to the jury, you should have 95% against my client, UHL, and 0 to 5% against the other two defendants, because we all know why they were here. I only had to bring them in because of the potential non-party that my client would argue, the empty chair. The jury found that you didn't prevail on his burden of proof with the other two defendants because he didn't put any evidence in, and they found in my favor as relates to the testimony from the witnesses following the truck about there being an explosion, about there being gravel thrown up into the windshield, about the lack of vibration or shaking of the truck, and the fact that there was no solid-state welding associated with these parts, such that it was a sudden failure that my client had nothing to do with.
I didn't notice in your brief that you responded to this or commented on this issue of whether the costs should be split 50-50 or allocated in some other way or what?
Well, I think the cost ought to be primarily against Ms. Turnbow. She's the one that received the giant amount of money, and that's the reason by which the case went as long and is the reason it was involved.
It seems like such a basic question. Well, I don't know what the answer is. Is there some rule? Costs are frequently awarded in multi-party cases, obviously. So is there some general rule about
it? I think it's a joint and several liability.
I believe it's a joint and several liability issue.
But knowing what I know about the monies that were paid, it seems to me that Ms. Turnbow would be the one to bear those costs. It's clearly up to them.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Buchholz.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And Mr. Allen, your time ran out, but since we harassed you with questions, we'll give you some more time.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Especially if you want to address another issue besides the voir dire.
I would just address the fact there was no African-American present on the other side of the V, but more importantly,
sitting at the table?
During voir dire. There was no African-American present on the defense counsel.
Right. But during the trial there was.
Yes.
Yeah.
Your Honor, the Class 8 driveline takes 1,350 pounds of torque every time the truck starts. It goes 27 times per second. There's no way that something like a chain or dirt or a rod is going to be able to find its way in there, given the force and the revolutions, and that was the testimony. What we've heard here is that, given the size and bulk of this thing, the driver had to have run something over, had to, if, as the trial court said, they accepted their expert's version. That means that the driver had some scintilla of fault, be it 5%, 10%, whatever. The point being, the jury allocated no fault to the driver, no fault to the truck driver, no fault to the other driver who was under the influence of marijuana at the time.
Yeah, but nobody was really arguing, or you certainly
were
not arguing.
But the point is, Your Honor, this is evidence that the jury was misled by the mere accident instruction because they obviously found it was a mere accident. That's the point. And that is proof.
But, of course, that accident instruction was a perfectly correct statement of negligence law. I mean, that's the difference between negligence and strict liability. The fact that an accident occurs doesn't mean that the injurer is liable.
But for the past 40 years, since the Indiana Supreme Court decision in Miller, those kinds of instructions have been rejected when they go to issues, as they did in this case, of negligence or of liability. They're perfectly fine, as Your Honor points out. If the instruction is a burden of proof instruction, if it's simply burden of proof, or in some circumstances foreseeability, but here the instruction went to liability, and across the board, every case has said it's unacceptable, even the most recent case, Costitas.
Your objection to that instruction, though, wasn't on the right point, was it?
Well, I would concede it was not artfully made, but it was in fact made in two ways. One, accident is not an affirmative defense upon which
the reason you're arguing now that it was improper instruction was not the reason you gave when you objected to that mere negligence.
I accept that, Your Honor, but it's irrelevant anyway because the trial court found it was not an accident instruction. The trial court said this is not a mere accident instruction, so regardless of what we would have said, it would have been irrelevant. The court did not agree that it was. And that is the reason why the jury came with zero fault. We had a plaintiff here. We had a plaintiff who had no fault. She was a passenger. She was entitled to some allocation of fault from these other defendants, even if the driver were 51% at fault. But here she had none. She was deprived of her adjudication, an adjudication required by the statute, unequivocal under the instructions, but the jury declined to follow it because they found, obviously, this was a mere accident. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Allen and Mr. Buchholz. And move on to the next case, Lauman.